If you're an environment minister meeting this week in France, whatever you do, don't say the two C words. But in Colombia, talking climate change is the whole point.
We are facing a new order, a global new order, so we need to be ready.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. We will have more on the continuing tussle over climate change. Plus, Cameroon's separatist violence has been especially traumatic for girls.
I saw girls who have forgotten how to play. Girls who jump at the sound of a door slamming because it sounds like a gunshot.
Also, Estonians are looking at the world right now and realizing that their future safety depends on drones.
We drive those drones to the front lines and we spend time with the soldiers because we need to understand what problems they have, how we can help them fix those.
Plus, new music from Brazil, all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Appreciate you joining us on this Friday. So, seven environment ministers walk into a room. Stay with me here. Six believe climate change is real. One works for a president who calls it fake news and doesn't want to talk about it. No, this is not the start of a bad climate-themed joke. It is the very real situation that ministers from the G7 group of nations faced at their meeting in Paris this week. Their solution? They are deliberately ignoring the words climate change. The World's Jerry Haddon starts us off today.
Just last week, before a French Senate committee, Monique Barbu had no problem with the two C words.
Le changement climatique et les pollutions.
The Minister for Ecological Transition, Biodiversity, and International Negotiations on Climate was discussing climate change, specifically water, and how to keep it clean. Climate change is increasing, she said. We must act before it's too late. Presumably, that's what Barbu really thinks. But on the eve of the G7 Environmental Summit in Paris, the host told reporters that being frank won't fly. Climate change, she said, would be off the agenda. Her ministry said they worried the U.S. would pull out if they bring it up, or even quit the G7 entirely. It is possible, given that President Trump has threatened to leave bigger institutions.
We were very disappointed with NATO, because NATO has done absolutely nothing.
And even the United Nations.
Not only is the U.N. not solving the problems it should too often, it's actually creating new problems for us to solve.
Basically, all of the global institutions designed around cooperation and consensus. With climate change scrubbed from the G7 environmental meetup in Paris, a U.S. delegate did arrive, though she's not a diplomat. Asha Maria Turner was received by Minister Barbu in Paris. Turner is a former energy exec turned assistant administrator at the Environmental Protection Agency. At a Senate confirmation hearing last June, West Virginia Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito asked Turner this.
What are some of the international environmental agreements, conventions, or partnerships that you would expect to prioritize?
It is the U.S. government's policy that it is the Department of State that sets international policy. Mm-hmm. That direction, of course, comes from the White House.
The Trump White House has pulled the U.S. twice out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Trump's views on climate change are no secret. This is how he put it back in September when addressing the U.N. National Assembly in New York. He took particular aim at the transition from fossil fuels to green energy.
It's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, in my opinion.
For many world leaders, then, it comes as no surprise that the U.S. is not sending a representative to another global conference taking place in Colombia. Over 50 countries are meeting for the first-ever conference on transitioning away from fossil fuels. There, climate change will no doubt be talked about. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
That conference Jerry mentioned on moving away from fossil fuels started today. It is hosted by Colombia and the Netherlands, and it is separate from UN efforts to tackle the climate crisis.
I think you might call this a coalition of the willing.
That is environmental activist Bill McKibben, who's been reporting and writing about climate change for years. He gave us his take on what sets this meeting apart from the UN summits that happen every year. Those are known as COPs.
The COP process has begun to just break down because first the U.S. is pulled out and there's a bunch of other recalcitrant players, Russia, Saudi Arabia, people that just refuse to deal with the fact that we have to stop burning coal and gas and oil or we can't solve climate change.
Hence this coalition of the willing, which is where we turn now. I spoke with Mexican lawmaker Laura Ballesteros, who was at that conference in Santa Marta, Colombia.
We need to keep together. So as you mentioned, the COP conferences has been breaking down. They are not creating the results that the world are expecting. So this conference is important because of that, to build something new and absolutely something that can bring people and community together. So right now I'm here because I am part of this huge global network that are bringing together parliamentarians all over the world so we can fight from the congressional process and the parliaments. The parliament is also important, not just the executive governments. Right now, it's clearly that they are not in the sight of the people and the future.
And what is the specific goal of this conference? What's the tangible takeaway that you're hoping to see by the end of it next week?
So I think two important components here in Santa Marta is to listen to the communities and their concerns, and of course, proposal. And in the other side, to bring a document together with the proper next steps and keep it on track for the next COP conference.
So this document that comes out of this conference will inform the COP process, that UN climate process. That is also what happens at these UN summits. There's a document at the end. Why would this be any different? Why would this actually move the needle toward transitioning away from fossil fuels? Is it because this is like a coalition of the willing instead of the whole world?
What they are trying to do here is to create a new phases of collaboration. I mean, if the new order are saying to us that the old organizations and the old conferences and the old spaces to get agreements are not working anymore, we need to create new ones. And Santa Marta is part of this new wave.
About 85% of your country, Mexico's, energy comes from fossil fuels.
Yes.
Your president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has advocated for a just transition away from fossil fuels. But the country is nowhere near on track to meet targets set out in the Paris Climate Agreement for cutting polluting emissions. What is standing in the way?
So again, we need new ways to organize the people who are fighting against this. And as you mentioned also, I'm part of the opposition party. So we have a very important proposal on the table that it is to start the transition right now. The key word here is transition, and they need to put money where their mouth is.
Mexico is a sovereign country, though. It can do whatever it wants with its energy sector. Why is a conference like this, where you will hear from and learn from other countries, why is that helpful or necessary in an energy transition?
Again, I will come back with a lot of new ideas, actions, and best calls to keep a better regulation. Right now, the government is working in a new fracking regulation. They are trying to create kind of a new frame to allow it. So part of the fight that we are trying to build here is how we can stop this from the Constitution.
Right. So the Sheinbaum government is trying to, what, allow for shale-based natural gas production, fracking, as you say? Is that right?
Yeah, they are creating from the government side a technical committee to investigate if it is possible to have sustainable fracking. The very name is so crazy to think about it, but we need also to keep all the evidence that the international community is working on to bring it on that table and also be part of the conversation.
And what are your specific concerns about fracking coming to Mexico?
Well, right now we have a lot of opposition in the community. I think it is not just a technical position that the government has to take care of. It is also a political and a social one. And the community that it is living on those specific territories right now are against that. They don't have any water right now. And we know that the fracking process involves a lot and tons of water to keep going on. And also they are trying to organize a lot of community assemblies to tell government that they are not in favor of this.
Fracking can also contaminate groundwater supplies, which would make a lack of drinking water worse.
With a lot of chemicals, yes.
So are folks opposing fracking because of concerns about like local environmental contamination? Or is there a concern about the government saying it wants to move away from fossil fuels, but also trying to open up this new extraction method?
I think it's in both ways. I mean, we need to hear from the people and be very careful about their needs. Last week, I received some part of these communities that are against the fracking processes, and they told us with this really vocal way to speak that if Mexico can allow fracking on their territories, they are going to die. As simple as that.
So there's a lot of concern there.
Absolutely.
But the Mexican government has such a large hand in extraction in the country. It has a near total monopoly on the domestic fossil fuel and electricity industries. You know, how realistic is it, and what would need to happen for a transition away from fossil fuels in Mexico when the government is so entwined with extraction?
Yeah, I think that when we have this kind of a scenario in front of us, this is exactly the moment that you have to be against it. So that's the reason why, again, we need to build a new kind of sales of organizations, international ones, community and local ones, to be part of this discussion and fight against it.
What would the Sheinbaum government say about what they are doing to move toward renewable energy?
As you may know, our president, Sheinbaum, she is very, very into the green agenda. She's a scientist of the environment. She studied in the United States. I mean, she understands a lot about what we are talking about. They have a very important program for the energy transition in our country. The big problem is that they are not investing on that. They are not putting the money where their mouth is. So when you don't see the money where the plans are, it is because they don't have political will. So part of the problem, in my understanding, is they have a lot of pressure from the private sector and also from the United States. So this is a very key moment for them to start working on what they are saying and also on what they are proposed for the people.
This conference has the same basic outline as a lot of other ones. Countries come together, talk about the need for action, sign a declaration, sit for group photos. Are you optimistic that something real, actual real change might come out of this?
You know what? Since a lot of time ago, I am not very enthusiastic when these kind of conferences. As I said, the COP, they are just breaking down and they are not bringing into the table what they are expected to. But this specific conference, for me, it is important. And I know that for most of the people who are assisting, is because we can create new kind of networks here. And these parallel kind of organizations can bring into the table much more than the officials ones. So I think it's interesting to keep an eye on this and see what will happen.
What can this conference not do for Mexico? What needs to happen and can only happen on home soil?
In Mexico right now, we are building a very important network of parliamentarians, Mexican parliamentarians fighting against climate change. So I am very glad to say that right now we have people from all political parties working on that matter. And this is the first time we have been trying to build this the last 10 years. And now it is the very first time that we are working together, not just the opposition parties, also the ones who are part of the government. So I really hope that I can bring into this national table these actions, these recommendations, these proposals, and see what we can do from there.
Laura Ballesteros is a Mexican lawmaker. She spoke with us from the first conference on transitioning away from fossil fuels in Santa Marta, Colombia. And now a palate cleanser after all that climate news, the debut single from a Swiss supergroup, Virage Zero. Virage Zero is based in Geneva. Its five musicians got together after success with other bands in the city, and they wrote their debut track, L'Arme de Feu, while they were on the road. Perhaps more songs like this one are to come, written from the back of their tour van. They could have a lot of driving ahead of them if they hit all the music festivals around Europe this summer. Coming up on the show, the situation right now for girls in North Cameroon. The International Rescue Committee has warned that girls are hidden victims of a conflict that has been raging there. More on that just ahead. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We go now to West Africa, Cameroon, to be specific. It is a country with two official languages, French and English, and identities based on which language you speak. For nearly a decade, there's been a fight for control of the country's two English-speaking regions. The separatist violence has killed thousands, displaced hundreds of thousands, and the UN reports disrupted the education of some 250,000 children. The International Rescue Committee has warned that girls are especially impacted as hidden victims of the conflict. Antoinette Chibi leads the IRC's teams in Cameroon and the Central African Republic. She spoke with me earlier from Cameroon's northwest region.
We're facing a social-political crisis that is rooted in the history and identity of people living in this region. So this conflict is often called the Anglophone crisis.
So there are separatists fighting for control against the government for the two Anglophone regions in majority French-speaking Cameroon.
That's correct.
And then there's a separate conflict in a different region called the Far North, and that is spurred by militant groups, including Boko Haram, correct? So two separate conflicts here?
Yes. The conflict in the Far North is driven by the spillover of the Lake Chad Basin crisis, where non-state armed groups stormed into Cameroon. So is the Islamic State in West Africa, ISWAP, and Boko Haram.
And so you are in the capital of one of the English-speaking regions, and you just returned from a conflict area outside of the capital. What were conditions like there? Was there active fighting, or people were displaced from previous fighting?
We went to visit one of our communities of internal displaced people. So people there are perpetual wanderers. So they flee into the bush or forest when fighting breaks out, and they live there for a couple of weeks, and then they return to find their homes looted or burned, or they have to uproot themselves and their family to other communities. Mm. And that's where we were in Tingo.
So are there options for people to flee outside of these regions, or are they all displaced internally within these two areas where there's a lot of fighting?
It depends. You'll have families that will actually uproot themselves out of the region entirely. You'll find a lot in suburban areas in Yaoundé and Douala and Bafoussam in the western and central regions of Cameroon. And others are displaced within the same regions, but in other subdivisions.
Your organization says that more than 4,000 schools are not operating in conflict areas in Cameroon because of the conflict. What is happening to those kids who used to go to those schools?
I want to tell you about a 12-year-old girl I met recently in the Far North. Her name is Amina, and her story is similar to most girls, even in the Northwest, Southwest. So 2 years ago, her school was attacked and burned. And today, instead of carrying a backpack and learning math literacy at school, she spends her day carrying heavy water containers or searching for firewood to sell. So every day, Amina is not in school. She's at a higher risk of being married off just so her family can have one less mouth to feed.
Mm. Your work focuses especially on young girls because they are more vulnerable when they are out of school. Is arranged or early marriage the biggest vulnerability there that these girls face?
Those girls, and they're not the only vulnerables. You have households that are headed by children. But our programs has a definite focus on girls because of the multi-sectoral vulnerabilities that they face. So with our program, we are creating safe space for them where they can receive psychosocial support, for example. So you can learn to read, for example, if you are still processing the sound of gunfire.
So what does school look like for these kids? I think you said there's accelerated programs, there's kind of informal programs. So does this look different than going to a schoolroom and getting a lesson from a teacher?
We try as much as possible to integrate these interventions within already existing settings. But as you know, 4,000 schools have closed in conflict areas in Cameroon. So when there's no school, we will create those temporary learning spaces where children can grow and learn. We also ensure that we are not just learning them the ABCs. It's also about social and emotional learning. So we train teachers not just to teach them math, but to recognize the signs of trauma.
Mm. As you said, you can't learn to read if you're still processing the sound of gunfire.
Indeed.
As you mentioned, the conflict in Cameroon is not one of the conflicts that is topping headlines these days. What are you seeing in your visits of the day-to-day impacts of this instability in Cameroon that you think it's important for us to know?
Well, right now, an IDP or a refugee, whether girl or men or women in the far north or the northwest of Cameroon, they're facing what I call a triple threat. The first one is physical. So a girl is at risk of being kidnapped when she's going out to fetch water for her family. The other threat is economical. So when families lose everything, then their daughters are often the first to be pulled out from school to help at home, or heartbreakingly to be married off to reduce the family's financial burden. And then the last one is the invisible one, the trauma. For example, in Tingo yesterday and Abonga the day prior, I saw girls who have forgotten how to play, girls who jump at the sound of a door slamming because it sounds like a gunshot. Mm. So this is the price that those children pay day to day while the world is moving ahead.
The invisible trauma, you said.
Correct. The international community has looked away.
Antoinette, where you're based in the capital of the Northwest region in Cameroon, what is daily life like there right now? Is there fighting?
In the capital, is peaceful. That's where all the institutions are. And that's why our team, our office in the capital is just for coordination. The majority of our team is based in the conflict-affected regions of the Northwest, Southwest, and Far North.
What are the challenges that you personally are facing in addressing the challenges of those across the country who have been displaced or affected by violence?
With the current environment, resources are scarce. So reduction of funding is affecting our ability to do more. That's why we're maximizing the resources that we currently have to ensure that we continue to reach our clients. That's our mission. And also what's going on around the world, the reality of the conflict that is elsewhere, for example, in the Middle East, has increased the cost of living for most of our communities.
Mm. So conflicts elsewhere are also impacting folks in the middle of these conflicts, driving up the cost of living in a way they can't afford.
Indeed. The fuel shortage has driven up the cost of everything, from the truck that delivers school supplies to the very food the children eat. We are seeing a massive spike in the cost of living that acts as a cost of learning tax, for example. Last month, in the far north, where families are already on the brink, this inflation was the final nudge for some of them to take their children out of school. And yeah, we definitely see that happening in our communities.
Antoinette Chibi leads the International Rescue Committee teams in Cameroon and the Central African Republic. We've got weather news, music, and some betting market scamming coming your way. This is The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You know about tornadoes, hurricanes, and hailstorms. You can add rain bombs to that list of destructive weather events. A rain bomb is an enormous amount of rain dumped practically all at once by hurricane-force winds blowing directly into the ground. They can be deadly. 5 people were killed and 140 people injured when a rain bomb hit a music festival in Belgium in 2011. That's described in the new TV special from Nova called Rain Bombs.
Out of nowhere, the skies darken. The powerful winds gust to over 80 miles per hour.
Please exit the tent.
Stages collapse.
Very quickly, within a couple of minutes, it became probably the heaviest rain I'd ever seen.
Sue Vandenhever is featured in the documentary. She's an atmospheric scientist at Colorado State University and joins us now. Sue, tell me more about what a rain bomb is.
So a rain bomb, Carolyn, is a narrow region of hurricane-force winds that rush toward the surface, often taking with them enormous quantities of rain and hail. Once they reach the surface, they rush out along the ground, very close to the ground, again at close to hurricane-force strength winds. Very destructive phenomenon. And they are challenging toward people. They're dangerous for people. They bring down power lines. They bring down trees and so on.
Have you ever been in one?
Yes, multiple. actually. They're a very frightening thing to experience.
Can you tell me more about what it feels like to experience one?
Yes, they last actually for a very short time. But because the winds are so strong, it kicks up a lot of dust and or vegetation in and around you. So the visibility often drops off very quickly. If it is raining and hailing very hard, the visibility is bad anyway. So difficult to see. You feel under threat. Even in cars and in vehicles, it can be a frightening experience.
How frequently do they happen? And is this the kind of thing that it happens in specific areas or all over the world?
I wish we had an extensive database on the counts of these systems. We don't. We do, however, have localized regional counts of rain bombs, or what is often called in the literature microbursts. They are often more intense in some of the drier regions of the world, but you can certainly find them throughout the continental US, throughout Europe, throughout Africa, Asia, and so on. So they are a global phenomenon, and I wish we had better numbers or better global database of them.
I actually had never heard of rain bombs before, and I'm curious if they're one of those things that is becoming more intense or more frequent because of climate change.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Again, the research still needs to be done in and around this, but I can tell you that they are generated by evaporation and melting. This helps to make them much more stronger. We know that as climate changes, some areas of the world will become drier, some areas of the world will become more moist. There's a lot we still don't understand about them and how their numbers may change in future climates.
So as you said, some areas will become drier, some areas will become hotter. The hotter areas will often become more wet. So is there a hypothesis about how climate change might impact these rain bombs?
If the atmosphere is containing more moisture, storms can more effectively produce more hail and more rain. And so these systems, the storms that produce microbursts or rain bombs, they carry around tremendous amounts of hail, almost astounding amounts of hail, more than a megaton. That's a million tons of hail, or 2 billion pounds, if you want to think about that, of hail. So if you can feed, or if nature feeds storms more moisture, and they become more effective hail and rain producers, those storms have to carry those around, and it sets up scenarios for them, you know, to release much more rain, much more hail toward the surface. That said, drier regions are more effective evaporators and melters, and that also enhances the strength of these systems.
So it sounds counterintuitively like they might get more intense in both areas that will get drier and wetter.
Yeah, Karen, that's exactly right. I think both regions set up for stronger systems for different reasons.
Yeah. I'm speaking with atmospheric scientist Sue Vandenhever about rain bombs. Sue, that rain bomb in Belgium that hit a music festival, it came in fast, something like only 20 minutes of warning. Is that common that they can appear with so little warning?
Yes, Carolyn, unfortunately, this is what makes them so challenging, is that they move in very quickly. They are very intense systems that develop over orders of minutes, and they're actually quite small in spatial scale. So the one at the Pukkelpop Music Festival in Belgium, it was actually only about 100 meters wide.
About as wide as a football field.
That's exactly right. So our ability to forecast such narrow and intense systems using our forecasting models is still, you know, it's still a very difficult problem for us to offer forecasts on that kind of system.
So I understand that airplanes sometimes get caught in these rain bombs and end up crashing. You speak in this NOVA documentary about when that happened to a plane taking off from an airport in Mexico in 2018. Can you tell me what happened there?
Yeah, absolutely. So this flight was taking off in July. I think it was the 31st of July, 2018. It was flying from Durango International Airport in Mexico. It was on its way to Mexico City, and it flew right through a microburst or a rain bomb. And as a result, experienced very heavy rain, as well as almost 180-degree switch in the wind direction. So why is that important to planes? When a plane takes off, it likes to take off into a headwind because the wind moving over the wing is what provides lift for the plane.
So if the plane is flying into the wind, then there's lift under the wings, you're saying?
That's exactly right. So that's what helps generate lift for the plane as it takes off. Well, as it flew, and this is typical of microbursts or rain bombs, they end up in producing a very rapid change in direction of the wind, over a very short space of time. So Aeromexico was only about 30 feet up in the air when it flew through one of these microburstal rain bombs, and it had an almost 180-degree switch in the wind direction.
Wow.
So that changes it from a headwind to a tailwind. The plane loses all of its lift. And if you're only 30 feet off the ground, you leave very little room for the pilot actually to do anything. And so Aeromexico actually didn't even make it clear the end of the runway. It actually crashed into the end of the runway. There were 103 people on board. Due to very rapid action of the crew, they got everybody off of the plane before it burst into flames. There were quite a lot of injuries and so on.
This is a scary thing to hear about, especially as you just talked about how hard these things are to forecast. Are there good systems in place for flight authorities to predict when one of these is coming to prevent accidents like that?
Yes, they are. And in fact, a lot of great instrumentation was developed in the U.S. There were a lot of aviation accidents in the 70s, 80s, and even the early 90s. And the federal government provided a lot of funding to look into these systems. And so what's been installed at most of the major airports around the U.S. are Doppler radars. These allow us to get a better sense of how the wind's changing near the surface and off the surface. And then around all of the runways, at many of the main airports, they have these anemometers scattered all around the runways.
Anemometers measure winds?
Anemometers measure winds. And so these are low-level winds, right? They're giving us indication of changes in wind speed and direction right near the surface.
You mentioned U.S. airports implementing new systems to help forecast rain bombs. Are international airports using them too?
Some international airports are. I would love to see them at more international airports. The airport that Aeromexico flew out of, they did not have these systems. Mm. Had they had these systems, that plane would never have been cleared to take off.
Mm.
So I would really like to see such systems being implemented around the world, you know, wherever possible.
And so I'm curious, you say there's been such great technological advancement to protect planes from these, but it's still very hard to forecast these more generally. Is that just because you're looking at conditions right now or in 5 minutes when you're talking to airplanes, whereas if I'm looking at a weather forecast, I might need to know something farther out?
Yes, that's exactly right, Carolyn. The scales of them both in spatial scales, right, they're very small systems, and in temporal scales, they develop so quickly, makes them very challenging to forecast with our forecasting models.
Hmm.
That said, our forecasting models are definitely getting better, and the more we learn about these systems, the better we can represent them in our forecasting models. So that is definitely improving. We have work to do, but it's definitely improving.
Sue Vandenhever is an atmospheric scientist out of Colorado State University. She appears in the new NOVA documentary Rain Bombs, which is streaming now on YouTube. Sue, thank you so much for this fascinating conversation.
Carolyn, thanks so much for having me and for, you know, being interested in rain bombs or microbursts.
Drones in recent years have become an important weapon of war. The Ukrainian experience in particular has shown that smaller, more agile drones are especially useful. Across Europe, security tech startups are playing an increasingly significant role in developing and producing them. Inside Europe's Ben Batke was in Estonia's capital, Tallinn, to meet up with Ragnar Saas, an Estonian tech entrepreneur who has pivoted toward defense.
It's just before dawn, somewhere on the outskirts of Tallinn. Estonian entrepreneur Ragnar Saas and a team of drivers are walking to a parking lot where around half a dozen trucks, painted black and khaki, are ready for departure.
Go.
The donated and retrofitted vehicles bear slogans like "Ukraine defends everybody's freedom" and "Orcs must die." The trunks are filled with drones, electronic warfare equipment, batteries, night vision cameras and mud tires. Saas is the man behind the convoys. A few weeks into the war, the successful tech entrepreneur and investor spontaneously bought a Toyota pickup truck after a Ukrainian soldier asked him for help when his car broke down near Kharkiv, the 49-year-old tells me.
And I putting it out, and it somehow went in small scale viral. Some journalist called me. Some people said, "How we can help you?" Some said, "How we can donate. Hey, I want to give my car."
In the 3.5 years since, over 40 convoys consisting of almost 800 pickup trucks have delivered 17 million euros worth of tailor-made aid and military equipment, including over 2,300 drones, according to Saas, directly from Estonia to Ukrainian frontline units.
Safe travels. Okay. Thank you.
Suss believes civil society-driven efforts like fundraisers, in combination with decentralized procurement, have been critical for Ukraine's survival, as they have allowed the military to adapt much quicker to the rapid evolution of the battlefield. Ukrainian brigades, for instance, can order drones and other weapons from two online marketplaces, using either privately raised or state money, as they see fit. Oksana Ferchuk, Ukraine's Deputy Minister of Defense for Digital Transformation, explained the advantages of decentralized procurement at the Tallinn Digital Summit last month.
The technology on the front line is changing every 2-3 weeks. You just cannot afford it, because the products you are buying, if you deliver in within a year, you will not have a military unit to supply to. The supply time now we see is 10 days.
One of the ways Estonia is reacting to this trend is by embedding civilian technology officers with domestic battalions to not only identify and solve problems based on troop needs, but also to have a procurement budget for experiments. Among the more than 50 volunteers, including 5 women, driving the trucks to Kyiv this morning is Denis, the Ukrainian founder of a charity, Social Drone, that builds drones for his country's armed forces.
Our volunteers make drones and then we process them, we repair, we test them, and then we drive those drones to the front lines and we spend time with the soldiers because we need to understand what problems they have, how we can help them fix those.
Before the full-scale invasion, Denis was a software developer in Kyiv and a hobby drone pilot. Feeling compelled to help the war effort, he switched from writing code to tinkering with drones full-time. Since then, according to Denis, Social Drone has delivered more than 55,000 drones to the military in addition to publishing video tutorials teaching volunteers how to build the drones. But Denis fears that red tape is hampering the adoption of this kind of DIY approach elsewhere in Europe.
I've spoken to many people from Europe who said that it's so difficult for them to innovate, especially because of the laws on flying drones. Europe countries should make it easier for regular people to just go out, fly, test drones, and not have to make like 10 papers with 50 stamps.
Another transferable lesson from Ukraine is that military strength isn't the only prerequisite to withstand and counter Russian aggression. In recent months and years, experts have increasingly pointed to societal resilience as another critical factor. They argue that EU countries need to invest much more in robust democratic institutions, psychological defense, and civil preparedness. Social Drone founder Denis says a total defense approach requires readiness on all levels.
It's everyone's job. On individual level, each person should understand that they will have to play a role. The state should be saying the truth, that if something happens, you would have to also take part in defense. Because if enemy forces come to your town and there is no way to escape, there is no way around fighting or just dying like it was in Bucha or Irpin.
Convoy organizer Ragnar Suss remembers the Bucha massacre, where Russian forces tortured and killed hundreds of civilians in March 2022 with absolute horror.
The war is here. The war is in Europe. It's just Ukraine losing the best people at the moment. So we know that this is our war to be sure that Russia would never end up here. We cannot just, you know, say, oh, we are tired. These people in the front lines, they cannot be tired. They have lost the best friends, the best comrades, and so on. So there's no chance. We have to help Ukraine win. So this war will end. The war can only end when Ukraine wins.
Ben Batke reporting from Tallinn for DW. His story came to us from the podcast Inside Europe. The weather in Paris this time of year is iconic, maybe even a cliche.
I love Paris in the springtime.
April in Paris. A feeling.
There are literally songs about it. Suffice it to say, there are some pretty big expectations for what April weather should be in Paris. So when officials noticed a couple weeks back that temperature readings didn't match expectations or even reality, it was clear something was amiss. A reel on the news site France Info explains that the state of one of the sensors at Charles de Gaulle Airport looked suspicious, as did the readings themselves. The temperature appeared to jump more than 7 degrees Fahrenheit in just 12 minutes.
Soit 4 degrés de plus en seulement 12 minutes.
The high temperature in Paris on April 6th, according to the sensor in question, was about 72 degrees Fahrenheit. The average high in April is closer to 60. So that wouldn't be so exceptional, except similar temperature spikes happened on other days around then. This all triggered a police investigation into possible tampering, and authorities found that a few bettors on Polymarket had wagered on the weather in Paris around that time, and they made bank by betting on unusually hot weather, sometimes on bets placed right before the sudden spikes. For French people, this whole thing came as a shock, in part because Polymarket is illegal in France. France Info gave viewers a primer.
C'est normal, puisque cette plateforme est interdite en France, et pour cause dessus, on peut parier sur un peu tout, et parfois n'importe quoi. Ça va de la couleur de la cravate que portera Donald Trump vendredi prochain au résultat de la présidentielle en France.
This presenter explains that it is a platform where you can make money by betting on anything, from the color of the president's tie to the outcome of an election. Here in the U.S., we have seen examples of what looks like insider trading, where people have made big money betting, for example, on the U.S. attacking Iran. But this version of gaming the system by actually attempting to change reality to match a bet, this is the first we have heard of that. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Brazilian state of Bahia is home to some of the biggest names in the country's music, Gilberto Gil and Caetano Veloso. A new big name also comes from that state, singer-songwriter Malie. She recently scored a Latin Grammy nomination for her debut album. Mas já que é pra falar de amor, vou começar com que acabou agora. Acabou agora. A gente conversou e mesmo assim cê foi embora. Cê foi embora, mas sabe, né? Malie is just 24, still in college, but she's been a working musician since she was 16, gigging in bars. Reporter Gisele Rigatão recently caught up with Malie, who's gearing up to release a second record next month.
Malie is showing me around a studio in São Paulo where she's putting the final touches on her new album. It's inspired by some reading she's done on Hermetic philosophy, which includes elements of mysticism and astrology. I started going deep on this topic, and I decided I wanted to talk about the soul, about my interaction with the world and the people around me, she says. It's a departure from her debut album, Amarissima, which is about falling in and out of love with other women.
O amargo e o doce em Amarissima, né, que é o superlativo do amargo. Eu sou dramático.
They're sweet and bitter in Amarissima, which is the superlative of bitter. My sign is Cancer, so I'm dramatic. Everything for me is exaggerated, she says.
Eu sofro muito, eu acho.
I think I suffer a lot, she says. Malie Louise Queiroz Araújo was born in a poor family in Salvador, the capital of Bahia. She started taking free piano lessons when she was 6. But a couple of years later, she switched instruments. I asked my grandma for an acoustic guitar, and she gave me one for someone who is right-handed. I'm left-handed, but I was so anxious to learn that I didn't ask her to exchange it. I learned to play on that one, and I even tattooed it on my arm, she says. Malie's dad played in samba reggae bands, and she grew up listening to music from Bahia, but also American R&B and soul. When she was 20, she released the single Azul, and it blew up. Though many well-known Brazilian musicians come from Bahia, it's not easy for them to succeed, says Julie Rodriguez. She's a journalist and producer of a radio music show in Salvador. Rodriguez says the mainstream press often looks down on them.
tentando colocar numa mesma caixinha artistas que são totalmente diferentes.
They try to place different artists in the same box just because they are black and from Bahia, she says. Melly's songs do not deal with racism or inequalities, topics often tackled by other black singer-songwriters in Brazil. But Rodriguez says her songs are political because of who Melly is.
Uma mulher negra falando de amor por outras mulheres.
She's a black woman talking about love for other women, something we couldn't even imagine a few years ago, she says. On her album, Melly sings with Latin Grammy winner Lineker, who is a trans woman.
Nada sem querer, faço tudo na intenção. Lembra aquele dia que eu peguei na tua mão? Foi pra marcar mais que o tempo e olhar. Foi pra dar saudade pra você querer pra si.
At a recent Melly concert in São Paulo, a fan named Ana Luisa Souza says her debut record spoke to her personally.
Amaríssima foi um álbum que me completou em um momento que eu precisava dele.
Amaríssima was an album that completed me in a moment when I needed it the most, she says. Souza went to her first Melly concert by herself in 2024, and she met Yasmin Sanchez. They are here together tonight.
Quarto ou quinto show, eu acho que eu tô perdendo as contas já de quantas vezes eu vim ver.
This is my fourth or fifth show. I'm losing track of how many times I've seen Melly live, Sanchez says. They will have even more chances to see Melly live in São Paulo. The artist just moved to the city. She thinks it will be better for her career. But she dreams about living in other places. Maybe New York City, where she performed a free concert at Lincoln Center last summer.
Queria fazer a faculdade de música, na verdade, a Juilliard.
To be honest, I want to study music at Juilliard, she says. But for now, she's working on getting a law degree and might also study philosophy, just for the fun of it. For The World, I'm Gisele Regatao, São Paulo, Brazil.
Since that conversation, Melly has had another big break. She has just released a single with one of the most popular current artists in Brazil, Anitta, who calls herself the girl from Rio. Her signature sound is a blend of funk and hip-hop, and her fan base spans the globe. The single that Melly and Anitta just released together is called Ternura.
Tive que chamar o chum, do rio me banhar, tô nas águas que guarda o tesouro.
The Portuguese word ternura means tenderness or affection, and that is the perfect note to go out on as we sign off for the week. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out more of our reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. On Monday, we'll have stories on the Iranian economy, Mexico's healthcare system, and more. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a lovely weekend.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Renee Vacchio Albi, Roman Mars, the Kelsen Foundation, and the Ken and Lucy Lehman family. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.